Thank you. Thank you, Chipmunk. It's good to be here, everyone. Chip grew up as a young man being called Chipmunk. That's where the Chip thing comes from. A lot of people think it's because his dad had the same name. Not true. He was called Chipmunk, and I wasn't supposed to tell you that. But it's a real privilege to be back at Southern and to be here. Hands up who have been to these things before we did a couple of years ago or before. So, okay. So if you can just kind of laugh at the same four jokes that we had from then. I haven't got any new ones, but it's a privilege to be here and to be with you as students. How many of you, just out of curiosity, are training to be pastors or church leaders? How many of you are already pastors or church leaders of one kind or another? So that pretty much covers everyone. It's a real privilege to be able to share music and share music with people who lead congregations. What I will say, a couple of disclaimers. Number one, I am not a theologian. I do not have a class on worship. If you're hoping to get lots of sort of theological background on the nature of worship or the history of hymnody or something like that, honestly, politely leave in the next 5 minutes because your hour will be spent better somewhere else. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to share a little bit about my background, about how I ended up writing these things that are called modern hymns. We're going to share a few of those, and that's going to take us around to about 1:40, and then at about 1:40. I'm going to open it up to questions. We can dialogue for a while. Then we'll finish the session with one more song, and I'll pray. Then we'll have a break. Then we'll come back for part two, if you can cope with any more of it. Okay? So that's the plan. So very quickly, just apologize for the six of you who've been here before. Chip asked me to say a few words about my background. I'm Irish. I've been Irish since I was born, and grew up in a home, a Presbyterian home largely, and grew up in church. And at the age of 10, got a guitar for Christmas, mainly because I knew it would make my parents unhappy. And after that, started to play songs, and my dad introduced me to songs like Majesty, Worship His Majesty, which I thought were actually rebel songs, not realizing they were Christian songs. A month later, I was playing in church in the Sunday school class, and really my whole teenage life revolved around music and church. It absorbed me at every possible level. It affected my social circle, affected my peers, it affected my heroes, but it also affected my passions, and ultimately ended up becoming my vocation and career. Reached university stage, went away to university, and both musically and theologically found my faith tested. Struggled to believe in the exclusivity of Christ, the uniqueness of Christianity, also struggled to believe in the Bible. And really it took me a year of sort of intellectual thinking, or at my level of intellectual thinking, that's kind of small, but, you know, pondering and debating at university, and came around to really believe that indeed Christ was unique among the quote-unquote religious leaders of the world, and that if his claims were correct, that I had to really follow him with one's whole life, and also to believe that the authority that he pointed to was the Bible. And so those things became all the more passionate after, even though they had been almost dissembled. The second thing was I got more involved in the musical world, both in the professional musical world and also through my classical music background, introduced to sort of what you would call high church music and all that, and then the historical liturgical music. And struggled a lot with modern worship music, partly because I was just a nasty person, but also because I struggled to understand where these foundational truths were in modern worship music. And also where they were in how they brought the family of God together. And so we started writing these modern hymns with two very simple goals. The two goals were to teach the Bible, to teach the great truths of the faith, and to write the great passages of Scripture and the things that we believe in into our hearts, into our minds, and into our memories through the songs that we sing. And the second thing was to write a kind of, being Irish and everything else, I kind of tended to write in a kind of an almost folk style for the most part. So I tried to write, where possible, hymns that could be sung by traditional churches, hymns that could be sung by contemporary churches, folk melodies that could allow hymns to be sung around the world in different languages, and indeed melodies that we could take and also work into that sort of classical high church world as well. So that really became kind of almost, that became the goal of the song. So try at least to write with a slightly timeless folk feel and work into those four worlds. We were involved in that during my 20s. Got involved in it. My creativity was really helped a lot by two people. for whom the most part of the genius of the lyrics owes the debt. The first one was Stuart Townend, who I met in the year 2000, just after I started writing these hymns. And then secondly, in 1999, just before that, the man who'd really helped me through did I believe in Christianity or not was Professor John Lennox at Oxford, who you may know from debating Richard Dawkins recently. And he called me back and said, you know, I have a little favor to ask of a niece who needs some help musically and spiritually, and I know that you're sufficiently older than her that you would have, you know, no other interest other than her spiritual development. So he introduced Kristen to me, and I tried to, with pure motive, do everything I could to help her in her career and date her. So those two people I owe a huge debt to as well. So when we talk about the hymns, I'm for the most part talking with the royal we about the three of us, but I think both of them would certainly want also to know that these are only my opinions to a large degree as well. But for the most part, I talk about the three of us in the writing that we've done over those years. So that's an introduction. Those are really the two goals of what we've tried to do with the songs, both the musical side and the theological side. The hymns that you may know, so we have something in common. You're familiar with In Christ Alone, which was the first hymn that Stuart and I wrote together back in 2000 and finished in 2001. And that hymn really came about just... the idea was to write a hymn that declared the whole life of Christ in a song. I was in a Bible study in 2000, and most of the people who are Christians often are quite articulate about certain areas of popular culture or about what the Christian church should be doing about this, but most of them struggle to actually explain what Christ did in being born, coming to earth, the incarnate one, dying, rising, and being able to articulate those things. And so we decided just to write a hymn which was going through the basics of the life of Christ. And so the first verse was a statement. Then the second verse began, you know, incarnation through to the cross. Verse 3, the cross to the resurrection. And verse 4, the promise that we have in the future. No guilt in life, no fear in death, through the promise of heaven. So it was really just a simple creedal hymn. And that was the first hymn Stuart and I wrote together. And we swore we'd never write together again after that because we just argued the whole time. But then we decided we would after we wrote that one. So it's been fine. So that's one example. The melody was kind of a folk melody. The lyrical style of the songs, we tend to write a lot of the stuff with quite a narrative quality. So for example, the modern pop song style or the modern pop song style, certainly post the kind of the singer-songwriters of the 60s and 70s, the pop music style has tended to be short songs for the most part, often that the lines can really go anywhere, and modern worship music, again, 60% of the time follows that pattern. We tend to tell stories in the songs, and that's a bridge just in art. It's something I encourage when it's done well, whether you're a worship leader or a pastor, but also just to think in your presentation. We were advised not to write these songs because there was no way of bridging the postmodern generation and the modern generation with the traditional generations. And because one wanted to sing theology and truth, the other wanted to sing experience and didn't want any theology. But the interesting thing was when you give them a story, when you feed something through a story, it helps them understand. Not only that, the Bible itself is just one great story. And so if we always are teaching the Bible, if we're always teaching the faith through this same story, if we're reasoning our struggles in life and other people's struggles through this great story, of redemption, it helps people frame. We are born that. We are made that way. Above all the laws and all the other things that we do, we're made to understand life through that. And that's the truth about salvation. The other song, which you may know, is The Power of the Cross, which we're not going to do those songs today. But I mean, that song was another simple song which tried to use a little bit of narrative. It was the idea. We almost imagined what it was like from Christ walking from Gethsemane to the cross. And so, you know, Odyssey, the dawn of the darkest day, Christ on the road to Calvary. So it again leads in that narrative. And then the chorus in the last verse, what it meant for Christ to die. Odyssey, my name written in the wounds, for through your suffering I am free. Death is crushed to death. Life is mine to live. Won through your selfless love, this the power of the cross. And it's the truth of the gospel, but it's also the freeing truth of the gospel, is that the song allows you both to look at the harrowing sufferings of Christ, not to pass over them or to sentimentalize them or to go on some kind of nebulous dream about either God's love or our nastiness, but actually considering what it was for Christ to suffer. But then in the last verse, celebrating the freedom and the liberty that we have to live, to move, to love, to laugh in the name of Christ. And so that was the first two songs that maybe kind of a familiarity. Can we open our book and we'll do some songs that we've been involved in the last 12 months? Behold the Lamb, I'm going to leave out for now. I want to start with songs we've written in the last 12 months. So the second one's called Come People of the Risen King. We did it in chapel this morning. Singing was good in chapel, wasn't it? You pick singing up well here, it's good. Male voices, my theory is, it's male voices. You know? Masculinity. To a degree. So anyway, this song was a call to worship. This song, in many ways, that we wrote, we finished it. The story of the song actually was, Kristen and I, when we got married, a friend of ours, just around the time we were getting married, and took me out for a game of golf one day and said, you know, I'm involved in a church in the Swiss Alps, and if you wanted to have a year after you get married, just living in the Swiss Alps, if you can lead worship for us 2 Sundays a month, we'll give you a car and 2 offices and a home and take care of you if that's any good. So I was about to swing and I went, well, let me pray about it, yes. And so we moved to the Swiss Alps for a year, and the Sundays we're home, we used to write songs for the services. And one week he wanted to pray about come to him all ye who are weary and I will give you rest. And I actually wrote this really slow melody. As a creative person, you're always trying to imagine something. So I imagined the travelers in the Lord of the Rings movies, you know, and coming near the end of their story. And Kristen wrote this hymn, O caller of the weary soul, I've heard you whisper rest. O caller of the weary soul, I have heard you whisper rest. And we did it for the service, and we finished the service, and we loved it, and nobody liked it, so we just kind of dropped it. And but a year later, I was thinking, the melody still haunted me, and so we pulled it back out again. We're working with Stuart, and we started just putting guitar chords to it and speeding the whole thing up with it. This works. This might actually be a call to worship, just at a totally different speed. So the melody rebirthed, and it became this song. And we really struggled to have good songs to open services. I'm Irish, so the tendency of the Irish, of course, is that all our wars are happy, and all our songs are sad. And so it's a joke. You can laugh. And so your music comes out usually as kind of slow or introspective, even though you yourselves are extrovert people. So it's one of our little idiosyncrasies. But anyway, so we didn't have many slots, so we thought this would be a great opening song. So the song, the first half of each verse is a call to worship in the tradition of the Psalms, calling to worship. But in the tradition of the Psalms, calling to worship, then halfway through the verse, you switch it round with the why. So you've come people of the risen King who delight to give him praise. Come all and tune your hearts to sing. Quick question, tune your hearts was stolen from what old hymn? Thank you. Another fine lyric written to an Irish melody. Okay? Come people of the risen King who delight to bring him praise. Come all and tune your hearts, tune your hearts to sing to the morning star of grace. From the shifting shadows of the earth, we lift our eyes to him whose steady arms, we'll lift our eyes to him whose steady arms of mercy reach to gather children, and the chorus, rejoice, rejoice. But we put a lot of the themes in there. So verse two looks at the truth that we come to worship no matter what our state of mind is. Come those whose joy is morning sun, those weeping through the night. Come those who tell of battles won, those struggling in the fight. For his perfect love will never change, and his mercies never cease, but follow us through a certain hope of peace. Again, the why. And then rejoice, rejoice. And it's interesting as well, as pastors and as music writers, there's an interesting tension we often have, isn't there? If you read many of the best-selling books in the last 10 years on the church, you're constantly told people are coming into church, make them happy as soon as they get there. They'll love it if they're happy for the first 10, 15 minutes, and the kids will start bopping to the music and stop annoying you and all this kind of thing, and everybody then feels happy. And in principle, it's a good principle. And, you know, I've been a concert producer for 15 years at one level or another, and I always, you know, you want the show to head off with a big song and all these kind of things. But we've got to be careful when people come into church that we're not feeding them a false truth. Because first of all, the Psalms tell us to come into his presence with thanksgiving, but a third of the Psalms are laments. And Psalms such as Psalm 88, which is the only of the 50 lament psalms, is the only one that doesn't resolve up to, you know, for you are, but you alone are God, and I will trust in you. It just resolves down to darkness is my closest friend. You know, it's like being with your mother-in-law. It's just so depressing. You know, so it's. But you read the psalm. That psalm was used as a preparation for worship. By the way, I love my mother-in-law. It was just a joke. So that psalm is an incredibly down psalm, but it was used as a preparation for worship. Because not every time you come to worship, you're supposed to be made to feel happy. And certainly not every time should the emphasis of the happiness be happiness. The emphasis is that because we have a God whose strength is beyond all things, who knows all things, and that this world, that there is a greater glory in life than our glory, and there's a greater happiness, a greater joy than our joy. And I think it's very important that as worship leaders and pastors, that the songs we sing, and the devotionals we bring and the sermons we preach are not there just to make people feel good about themselves, but that there's a reality to it. There is a reason why the fallout between 15-year-olds and 35-year-olds in Britain is something like 70% of church people who claim Christian at 15, 30% of them claim to be Christians at 35 in the UK. And you may say, well, the UK is a pagan country. Well, let me tell you, it was very similar to this 40 years ago. And so we must not sell our people on Christianity makes you happy, because sooner or later Christianity is not going to make them happy. And sooner or later something else is going to come around that's way more attractive. And so there's got to be something more than that. So that's just a quick sort of just reflection. And verse 3, come young and old from every land, women of the faith. Again, this is something we're passionate about. I'm not making an ultimate comment here about specialized services or male, whatever the word is for integrated worship. I have all these kind of words over here, but you know, I'm not saying one has to be. But the radical aspect of worship is not the music at the front or the people at the back. The radical aspect of Christian worship is the fact that it is young and old. It is men and women. It is people from every tribe and tongue. It is people who are as rich as get out and people who are as poor as get out, who are as clever and as stupid and of every color, all gathering in the room like no golf club or sports club or health club will ever be able to boast. And that is the radical thing of Christian worship. So over and above trying to get our numbers as big as we can by 2012 to hit a new church growth Starbucks record increases target, the radical thing is actually about this whole journey. So a lot of these thoughts come into writing this song. Shall we just sing it through a couple of verses just so you don't have to listen to me for 2 minutes? So here we go. Here we go.
Come people of the risen King, who delight to bring him praise. Come all and tune your hearts to sing to the morning star of praise. From the shifting shadows of the earth, we will lift our eyes to him. Where steady
young and old. voice. So that chorus, bringing us back to the unity thing, rejoice, rejoice, let every tongue rejoice, one heart, one voice, so Church of Christ. It's a gathering song, but it's gathering us as one family. Let's turn over. In fact, let's go on a couple to Creation Sings the Father's Song. As in, many of you have pointed out that over the last 3 years, many of our songs, Hear the Call of the Kingdom, the Communion Hymn, Come People, Creation, Compassion, a lot of these hymns have actually been Kristen and Stuart, now the three of us writing together. People often ask what's that's like, and it's kind of curious. It's if Stuart disagrees with Kristen on a lyric, and it's like 30 minutes before dinner time, and you're wondering, do I say this and risk not getting any dinner, or do I wait till tomorrow? It's an interesting thing. That was a joke, by the way, everyone. So, but it's we have a lot of fun together on the songs. One of the great things is Stuart almost was a mentor to me when we started, but when we started. The last couple of years, just for one reason or another, he's had less time. And so he's been able to encourage Kristen to write and then help sort of mold the lyrics. But one of the things Kristen has brought to the table is a kind of a wonderful female sort of poetic thing going on. I mean that in the nicest possible sense. Just a different kind of touch. So a lot of these wonderful lines, like around the table of the king in the communion hymn. Or this one, Creation Sings the Father's Song. Often come, from her kind of idea. Actually, what literary figure would have inspired both of those titles? No. At a distance. It's more obvious. Creation sings the Father's song around the table of the King in the communion hymn. Yeah. C.S. Lewis. It was, they're both from the Narnia stories. Around the table of the King was the image. From Land, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and Creation Sings the Father's Song from the Magician's Nephew, and Aslan sings the world into being. I am informed, and remember from reading Leonard Bernstein's music, The Language of Music lectures, the Charles Eliot Norton lectures, that he talks about the Hebrew really in Genesis 1, where God sings the world into being. But that was that was the idea behind the song. I look at creation. It was written. People often say, what comes first, the words or the music? And usually it's the phone call. And the phone call for this one was we were talking with Kristen's uncle, John Lennox, who introduced us so naively so many years before, who was doing a series of talks on creation, and we're doing a conference with him. So we tried to write this song. The goal was to write it for the conference, and we finished it, I think, 2 hours before the conference started, 9 months later. And the first verse, again, it's more of an opening, just looking at his fingerprints and flecks of snow, his breath upon the spinning globe. He charts the eagle's flight. And then into this chorus, Alleluia, let all creation stand and sing. Alleluia, fill the earth with songs of worship. Tell the wonders of creation's king. And in the second verse, it looks at, of course, Christ, creation, gazed upon his face, the ageless one in time's embrace. It was a beautiful phrase, I think, for incarnation. Unveiled the Father's plan of reconciling God and man. A second Adam walked the earth, whose blameless life would break the curse, whose death would set us free. And in verse 3, looks to the future. Creation longs for his return when Christ shall reign upon the earth. The bitter wars that rage, birth pains of the coming age. That theme in Matthew 24, isn't it? That all creation, these are the birth pains of the coming age, what it will be like. That the very soil that we stand on, the very stones that this building is built on are actually are groaning for Christ. Actually, these stones could cry out that Jesus is Lord. That's what Christ claims. It's an interesting thing if you ever get to talk to somebody who's slightly universalist, that they like Christ's his love and his peace bits, and a couple of the Sermon on the Mount things and the Beatitudes kind of appeal to their sensitive side. But they don't want all this nasty Old Testament stuff. Well, Christ claims that even the ground that we stand on, of course, could claim that Jesus is Lord. And interesting reflection. But so we wrote this, and so it was really looking at creation and how the very snowflakes and the very ground that we stand on, and indeed all of history, proclaim that Jesus is Lord. Do you want to sing this one through? Musically, it's a little bit Musically, this is for, here's something for musicians. Anybody who's not a musician, close your eyes. Close your ears. You'll be bored by this. But it was written. It's a completely irregular melody, and the melody was actually written by my wife, which is kind of, you know, having had a career in music and, you know, claiming that your identity is as a musician professionally, you know, and then having a wife that can't read music who writes better melodies is a little bit soul-destroying sometimes, you know, but it's okay. And she came up with this kind of unusual melody, and it's really funny because every time we work with, we've been to several churches, and they've said, look, we can do all your songs, but our choir cannot get the rhythm of this because they sit and count it out and try to get it. But actually, if you haven't thought about it and you just sing it, it just flows completely naturally. And Chris and I had actually been listening just to some playing song around about that time, so I think that might have been it, because it was just natural speech rhythms as opposed to metric. Again, if you're not a musician, you've probably wondered why you've had to live through the last 2 minutes. So ignore that. And you can all read music, can't you? Why don't we stand up and sing this one? Brett, is it better if I sing into the microphone or take the microphone off? Just keep singing, okay? Here we go.
Creation sings the Father's song. He calls the sun to wake the dawn and run the course of day till evening falls and runs away. His fingerprints and throats of soul, his breath of love is spinning gold. He charts the eagle's fly.
Take a seat. So we got that. Again, a lot of our songs at the minute, we've tried to almost last year try to push the boundaries a little bit more with the rhythm of our writing. We actually, in the last song, "Come People of the Risen King," we usually sing it with a plain song called to worship, but the Hear, O Israel, a variation on the Shema of the Old Testament, the Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God. And so tonight we're going to, in the concert, we're going to do two or three sort of fun songs at the start. And then we're going to do one song at the start, and then we're going to go straight into this rather call to worship. And then it'll lead into Come People of the Risen King. So that's another thing you can use. I meant to be said about the last song. It can work as a solo or a choir. This song, again, the rhythms are just a little bit more interesting. As an artist, you're always trying to try new things to keep things fresh. But I felt also with our congregations, one of our goals is to really help congregations sing melodies that maybe are a little bit more interesting. But often like in any other form of art, like if you're tasting a food for the first time, for example, the more interesting flavors take a while to get used to, but they can often be, you can enjoy them for a longer time. And many of the great hymn melodies, actually, some are very, very simple, but some are actually, some are good, but enormously complicated. But once you get them, you know, you hold them for life. So that's kind of a little aside. Let's do the compassion hymn, then we'll go to questions, okay? I'm talking way too much, am I, Chip? Chipmunk, you'll tell me if I'm talking too much, won't you? Okay, this is an Irish melody. You're a very quiet group. Is this a Baptist thing or a Louisville thing? Or this is an Irish melody. Do you want to do a quick two minute break? Is that okay? 2 minute break. To get yourself used to singing Irish melodies, do you want to learn to talk Irish? Do you want to learn to talk Irish? Okay. Vowels first. A. A.
A.
Again. It's like a choir rehearsal, Chip. A.
A.
E.
E.
Wider. Wider mouth. E.
E.
Yeah, yeah. I.
I.
And more sort of back of the mouth.
I.
I. A quick coarser. Once more.
I. I.
Good. Then O. Really, really round. Ooh. Ooh. Now, almost sing it like a different pitches. Ooh. That's good. Then, ye. Okay, tongue, front of the mouth. Ye. Like you're pushing it out. Ye. Then the key consonant is the R. R. Now, this is, once you got this, you're through. Okay? You know? R. Yeah, R is the key one. It's like, in Reformed theology, it's like predestination. Once you've got over that one, you're flying towards the finishing line, you know? So it's R. Okay, how are ye?
How are
ye? Very well, thank you. How are you? Good. Okay, so here's a quick song. Back to the lecture again. Okay. Okay, if you can take that out of the thing, it's got absolutely nothing to do with the rest of the lecture, okay? Song on compassion. It's, again, a lot of these songs really come from the struggles in one's own life, but realizing that the struggles in any one person's life are often the struggles in most people's lives, and it's an amazing thing. Russell was talking this morning about how ruthless Christ was when he spoke in criticism of people, and yet at the same time, constantly throughout his life, the friend of the sinner, the friend of the weak, the friend of the homeless, an irresistible godliness that drew people who, in their failures, wanted, desired godliness towards him. And it's an amazing thing that throughout his life, this theme of compassion was always consistent with strong rebuke. It led to action. It was never a feeling, and then a nebulous signing up to some document. He looked in the people and saw them as sheep without a shepherd, and he was filled with compassion. So he feeds the 5,000. It moves to action. And then, of course, in the cross, we remember studying the cross, just looking at it, and the acts of compassion around the cross. Even though it was the darkest moment in human history, Christ still having the time to take care of the soldier's ear, you know, or just the little incidents along the way. And that level of care for people is remarkable. And of course, the cross itself being the supreme act of compassion. And so we gathered all the passages in Scripture that look at compassion, Old Testament and New Testament. And you'll see in this song, many of them kind of hidden in or buried in throughout the song. And we did it this morning in chapel. Again, melodically, it's slightly Irish, as I said, but again, it's also slightly more irregular. There's kind of three upbeats into the first bar. So as there is an everlasting kindness, which again takes a little bit used to get used to. But we'll sing through it. Why don't we stand up and just sing it again, just so we get our leisure break.
lavished on us when the raiders of battle came to rescue the lost. We called the shepherd out of Sharon to hear their distress. For your streams are for us and the shade of your.
Verse 2. And with compassion.
And with compassion for the hurting, we reached out your hand as the lame ran to meet you, and the wind breathed again. You saw we had the eye of sorrow and shed in a tear, heard the sigh of worry that the children draw near. What boundless sorrow!
We stood beneath.
We stood beneath the cross of Calvary and gazed on your face and the thorns of oppression and the wounds of disgrace. For surely you have borne our suffering and carried our grief as you pardon the sorrow and show grace to the thief.
Thank you so much.